Hello and welcome to this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. If you're a regular listener of our podcast, you know that Revenue Rocket is the world's premier growth strategy and M&A advisor, tech-enabled services companies. With me today are my partners, Matt Lockhart and Ryan Barnett. Welcome, gentlemen.
And good to be here, Mike. You know, we always touch on a little bit, well, not always, but oftentimes touch on for our listeners where we're at in the, let's say the lunar calendar. Well, it's getting cold out. So, you know, we're up here in Minnesota, and you betcha it's going to start to trend towards cold up here. But that just means it's time to get some things done before the end of the year.
I agree with you. It is time to get the things are humming along. And then something we're going to talk about something today that is a little bit of a debate amongst people in the profession, and want to give some guidance on where we think something should happen. And it's all regarding to the process around a letter of intent. And really the topic here is we have seen letters of intent vary from something on the back of a napkin to a 20-page tome. Today what we're trying to talk about is what's right and what should buyers and sellers expect in that letter of intent, and what are some pluses and negatives to take in an approach like that. So, Mike, you know, why don't you get us kicked off with just some terminology, and, you know, what is a letter of intent, and I'm going to follow that up with what is an indication of interest as well, as sometimes these two go together. So help us out with some definitions, and then we'll dive right in.
Sounds good, Ryan. Well, a letter of intent is typically used when a buyer wants to acquire another business, at least in our world. And it should outline, you know, a variety of things that we'll get into in a minute. But at a minimum, it should outline price and terms of a deal. Should involve kind of at least reference that there will be, you know, working capital needed and maybe some remedy for or the mechanism for remedy within a reps and warrants violation, should there be one, et cetera. So there's a handful of things that need to be in that letter of intent to give comfort to a seller who's about to sign this agreement. Which usually includes what's called a no-shop clause or a lockout, that their buyer has an offer that they would accept. And if they can get everything else negotiated in the definitive agreements, that it's warranted kind of, you know, taking their firm off the market to align with that particular buyer. An IOI, on the other hand, is a kind of a broad indication of interest, generally used in a sell side process when a broker or an M&A advisor is using a sell side process to determine buyers that have interest, their general level of price and terms for a particular firm. And it's used to qualify either buyers in or out to ultimately produce a letter of intent. That's different. It doesn't include a lockout. It generally is not as detailed as a letter of intent. And think of it more as a screening process or qualification process for firms that generally are represented for sale. Now, it's not always that way. There are certain buyers that are more comfortable using an IOI as a indication of interest, as a qualification mechanism for a seller. Basically say, hey, if we go to the work of producing an LOI at this level, will you accept it? And so sometimes it's, you know, the company's not for sale per se, but that IOI generally comes first before an LOI. And it's either used by someone who's running a process, or in some cases by buyers that just want to get alignment with a seller around price and terms before authoring an LOI. Hopefully that helps, Ryan.
Yeah, that certainly helps. And we'll go into this a little bit too. I would say there's a camp in which a firm may want to skip an indication of interest and go straight to an LOI. And so I think it's one of those cases where we need to know at least what these documents mean. So if I was to summarize what you said, a letter of intent is a indication, a non-binding indication that defines at the highest level price and terms for the consideration of a business, but also includes typically a exclusion clause and an NDA clause or confidentiality clause. So an indication of interest may be a ballpark shot across the bow, if you may, to say we're interested in the business at this amount, should we do a little bit more? Again, generally speaking, that's the large thing. Matt?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's two key words in the difference between the two, and then we can kind of move off the IOI front. So, and they both start with I. One is interest, and the other is intent. In an indication of interest, you are demonstrating that you're interested in these general parameters, right? Versus in a letter of intent, you intend to carry through with the transaction so far as everything that has been produced for that and that information to arrive at a letter of intent stays true, right? Through a due diligence period post letter of intent. And I bring this up because I think it's absolutely critical. And I think that there are, well, quite honestly, bad actors out there that produce letters of intent that really maybe should be more indications of interest, right? That they aren't necessarily fully ready and intending to carry through with transaction. So I was just thinking about that in that context of IOI versus LOI, but really think about interest versus intent.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation, and it's exactly where company where you kind of see the difference. It's really interesting you bring up kind of the bad actors. You know, it's very common for, or not very common, we see it, for companies to, you can indicate your interest or put a letter of intent forward that has an enterprise value of, let's say, a huge amount larger than the valuation, and, you know, terms to be determined. And those terms might be something like a 90% earnout. And there's something where you've got some almost ridiculous terms in it. But I'm going to go back to the question, or kind of back to Mike, and I just want to reiterate this. If the leading line typically in an NDA, in a letter of intent, quite literally is this is a non-binding letter of intent. And so if a deal doesn't close, you know, what portion of that LOI survives?
Yeah, good question, Ryan. So it's important to note that, that almost any LOI, and this isn't 100% universal case, but I would say it's, well into the 90 percentile, on LOIs will include what's called a lockout clause or a no-shop clause. And there are specific reasons for that. What it does is it allows a buyer who's about to expend quite a bit of money, as well as a seller, comfort that deal's not gonna, or from a buyer's perspective, not gonna get sold out from under that buyer, meaning that you're not continuing to market it or working with a broker or entertaining multiple offers. You're committed to that buyer. It also means that they can justify the expense. In some cases, buyers have to do a quality of earnings analysis, do material detailed diligence. They've typically hired lawyers and accountants and folks to do that. And they may expend, hundreds of thousands of dollars in that diligence effort. And they want to have comfort that if they do that, you're not going to, walk away from the deal to sell to someone else. They don't want to lose to someone else, and that's a reasonable expectation. Typically, that lockout clause will survive for whatever period of time is outlined in the LOI, even if you terminate the LOI. It means essentially that you're off the market for that period of time, during that lockout. And generally, a defensible lockout is one that, doesn't last a long period of time after negotiations might break off. Typically only lasts a reasonable duration of a due diligence effort to close, which is typically 90 days. So, that's certainly something that would survive. Confidentiality would survive, and typically there's a confidentiality provision in an LOI, but it's generally redundant to an NDA that was signed earlier. So you have sort of multiple levels of protection, and depending on the wording of the NDA and or the LOI, you may be held, both parties may be held to a material non-disclosure period as well. And so that's certainly something to be aware of as you move forward.
So if you have a signed into LOI, what's typically next in the process? So to go through due diligence, but then what's the next legal document?
Well, this is an important point. So if a LOI is a non-binding agreement, other than the provisions we just discussed, it means that you need to develop a binding agreement, and that is a definitive purchase agreement. And it's either an asset purchase agreement or a share purchase agreement or stock purchase agreement. Those terms are used in interchangeably. And they will be, those are the legal binding agreements. So you'll want to make sure you work with your M&A advisor and your lawyer to effectively get those built and fortified properly. And so typically that takes a little bit of time, as you can imagine. There's a material amount of documentation in order to either sell your business or acquire a business. There's many, many exhibits that have to be produced to have that be done. And typically those exhibits include, all kinds of things and attestations around reps and warrants, for example. So we've talked a little bit about that in the past, sort of the components of a definitive agreement and what to look for. So I'd encourage you to tune in to some of those podcasts. But the next logical step is diligence on behalf of the buyer, which looks more materially at your contracts and your financials and, forecasts and might include backlog reports and front log reports and a variety of other things, as well as stepping into the development of all those definitive agreements.
So if I frame this up right, if a letter of intent is issued and agreed upon, you've got general terms. And for the most part, those general terms should be reflected in the agreement. However, it's not going to have everything. So you may not have the details of an employment agreement, or you may not have the amount of working capital needed to hold back. But you may say things in a letter of intent, like it could be a cash-free, debt-free transaction with a holdback for adequate working capital. There's some kind of looseness in the LOI compared to tightness that you have to have within the binding agreements. So this gets us kind of the crux to our debate, is that, we've seen longer LOIs, we've seen people go through longer processes. Why would someone have a longer LOI? And maybe Matt, maybe you want to start with this, Why would you have a longer one if it's non-binding in nature?
Well, it's a good point, and it is there's no perfect answer, right? It's not an absolute science. There's some art in just how much you stipulate in an LOI, because of the fact that it's all non-binding. In some cases, the agreed upon, like verbally agreed upon structure is really quite simple, right? And it's a 90x% cash based deal, with an understanding that there's going to be a holdback for reps and warrants. Well, in that case, the LOI can be pretty simple and it can be pretty short. On the other hand, both parties have agreed to a more complex structure. And, you know, for all of our past listeners, you know what I mean by structure, right? The terms. So, for example, maybe there is a gain share situation. There's an earn out and a gain share situation that is a little bit more complex that is agreed upon. It's the right thing to do for both parties. Protection for the buyer, upside for the seller. And you want to spend a little bit more time on specifying out what the, you know, sort of what the arrangements are around an earnout and gain share, type of a relationship. You know, maybe there's an intent that is, you know, even more complex that, this is, sort of subject to, other conditions that need to be met prior to close, right? And so, there's a variety of those things that may be done, right? But, you know, you want to be a little bit more specific in that scenario within the letter of intent so that all parties know that it's, you know, while it's not binding, they're down the path far enough so that it makes it easier to execute that due diligence period. And to some extent, you know, when I say it's a bit of an art versus a science, it's you kind of have to read the room and you need to read the people. Some people are, just by nature, they're more detailed, right? And they're going to have a high degree of discomfort in signing something if there's not a little bit more detail put in there versus others, you know, they're sort of more trust based, relational based, and they know that if they've got enough, right? And it's not everything spelled out, but they've got enough that they've got a really good feeling about the other party and they know they'll be able to work through, some of the smaller conditions post LOI. So, you know, it's not a perfect science. There are reasons to have more. Now, if you talk to a lawyer, boy, they're going to say, hey, look, I want to spend a good 10 hours on this LOI and I want everything stipulated out to the nth degree, right, in an LOI. And well, Mike, I don't know how you feel about that, but I think that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I would agree. I would tell you that, you know, we've seen a lot of LOIs. And Matt brings up a good point. You know, each situation is slightly different. It's my opinion, that if you can get to agreement, in principle on price and terms, and the components that will, be in a, transaction, that's enough. Right, along with a no shop or lockout provision. I think the deeper you go in pre-diligence, what we'd call pre-substantive due diligence or pre-LOI due diligence, the longer you run the risk that, you know, if you're a buyer, that the seller may change their mind, right? Or they may get another offer. We've certainly seen that, you know, in IT services, it's a competitive space. There's always people getting phone calls about doing a deal and typically if they've agreed, you know, and are negotiating with you to do a deal and, they get another phone call that looks more interesting or better, you could potentially be the deal that you're working on getting formulated into an LOI could be sold out from under you. And so I think there's a window of time where you have to move fairly quickly. And you have to be able to be nimble and you have to be able to get to a point where there's enough of an agreement to realize that you should be coming together much more closely to work on substantive due diligence and move towards defining agreements that are legally binding. If you spend too much time up front, certainly there's some benefits to that. You can mitigate some of the negotiations you're going to have later. pursuant to a definitive agreement. But the argument sort of against that is that you run the risk that the deal could be sold to someone else, or that maybe you're, you know, you run into a situation where the seller, you know, gets to a point where they just get worn down by the process of the negotiation early, and they just decide to not sell. And we find that once someone has clarity about the transaction, and has guidance as to what to be, could be expected, they're a little more patient with being able to negotiate some of those things into a definitive agreement, knowing that you're, you know, moving towards a close versus still in many ways shopping, right? Still looking at them saying, well, could this deal work, and how should we structure it? And, you know, what about this and what about that? And so I think my personal bias, and I know others on the team have a little different opinion, is that less is more when it comes to LOIs, and speed of execution is pretty critical to, you know, make sure you can either stop the discussion if there's no fit of either price and terms and or components of a deal, or proceed with confidence that, you know, you have the major boxes sort of figured out, and that you can now get into some of the details that will require everybody rolling up their sleeves for, you know, a period of months.
Yeah, you know, Mike, I think you make a really good point around the timing. Is it's also recognize that part of the purpose of the due diligence period is to further the relationship. And you want to spend enough time, obviously, on the strategic fit and the cultural fit prior to issuing a letter of intent. But you're not going to be done with that. And so there shouldn't be an expectation that you're going to be done with, you know, furthering your understanding of those pieces, especially the cultural piece, right? Because it's once you get past an LOI, it's like everybody, you know, sort of takes a breath and they're like, okay, we're doing this, right? And now I'm going to, you know, I'm going to drop my guard a little bit, right? And let people in, and we're going to build that bridge and build that relationship. And part of building that bridge and relationship is building that cultural alignment. And so if you're too hard in negotiating, well, you may never get the chance to build that bridge and build that relationship. On the flip side, right? If you go in and remember, there's that really important I, there's that intent piece, and you go in and you don't spend enough time to ensure that you really mean that, and you're standing behind that intent piece because you went too fast, well, then you may get a reputation out there.
I think some really great points here on both sides. You know, what I'm hearing, ultimately, the things come down to that definitive agreement. At the same time, there's a lot of trust that is built between buyers and sellers when coming to that letter of intent. And ideally, a majority of that letter of intent should come through to the definitive agreement. So we want to make sure that, and this is a concept of a retrade. We sometimes will see a deal change major terms in the definitive agreement. Typically, things like the enterprise value, things like the structure of the deal may not, those are typically not, they certainly can be negotiated because it's not non-binding, but those are ones that we look for the spirit of that deal to still stay true through the end here. But keep in mind that letter of intent is always non-binding, and many things can change along the way. Any closing thoughts here, guys, before, or any other alternative thoughts before I summarize here?
I'll say one thing, right, is that regardless of whether or not you want a little bit more in the letter of intent, which, you know, naturally requires that you do a little bit more diligence up front prior to that letter of intent. Or you've got enough and you are intending to move forward, even though, you know, there's some gray area out there. Don't waste time yourself, right? It's like, be efficient. Have a plan in your M&A process so that you are as efficient as possible within your own organization to get the decisions that you need and the information that you need. Because to Mike's point, time kills all deals, and time can kill even the opportunity to come together with another party in the form of a letter of intent if you are wasting time yourself. So that's the only other piece of guidance that I'd give around that letter of intent piece. Beyond that, you know, we do this every day and we love to have the discussion. If you have any questions that we didn't cover, man, we'd love to chat.
Yeah, I'd probably add also a thought around, and I think you summed it up well, man, that too many turns on an LOI, regardless of what's in or out, can erode trust. And I think it's important to have a dialogue about what's acceptable between buyers and sellers and generally get alignment before a letter of intent is probably drafted. And that way it will make fairly short work of negotiating a letter of intent. I know some like to go through a much more protracted process where, you know, they're issuing kind of an offer, an IOI, and then a longer term LOI. Or longer form LOI, and that can be effective for all the reasons we talked about. But you certainly can't do that in a vacuum without talking to people and talking to each other about what makes sense and what are some of the things that you would expect. I think if you do that well ahead of time, regardless if you use a more short form LOI or a longer form LOI, it will make much shorter work of getting that document authored properly and signed officially.
Makes sense. So if I summarize this up a bit here, you know, in general, an indication of interest, you know, that's you putting forth that you're interested in pursuing a transaction, and you'll have some general terms, let's say an enterprise value out there. The next step is typically going to be a letter of intent, and that letter of intent is that you're gaining payment in terms and deal structure with some general provisions, and you're really outlining what's a potential for a close. I want to stress in this, it's non-binding in nature, with the exclusion of what we heard here in the NDA and typically the no-shop provision. Other than that, everything can change. If we think about a longer LOI, you know, it might bring a lot of clarity to the deal and answer a lot of questions that may come up throughout due diligence. And it might provide a seller with a little bit more confidence and understanding what they're going through and what to expect. However, it might take longer to craft that LOI. And there's so many points that may be put into the LOI that it brings the need for legal counsel up into the LOI section. And it's still a non-binding document. So there can be struggles with that longer document, even though the clarity is there, the non-binding nature still remains. At the same time, a shorter LOI, you may have some clarity, some deal terms, but you may not get enough, and the seller may feel like they just don't, that the deal was changed underneath them. And that can be unsettling to a seller. So as you get through the negotiation, it can be a challenge. That being said, you get someone under a lockout and you start hammering out the terms and the point of the deal that really matters, which is the definitive agreements. So put your legal resources, time and money into the spots that actually matter. So I think that both have their points here. I think we're advocates of getting a signed LOI that includes an exclusivity clause and really hammering out the details, but still keeping true to the terms and the spirit of the deal that's outlined in that LOI, at the very least around deal terms and structure. With that, I'll turn it over to you for closing comments on Matt and Mike.
All right. This was great. Yeah, this was great, Ryan. Thanks for the topic. I think we had a couple of executed LOIs just this week, so it's a timely deal. Mike, how do we close this bad boy out?
Well, as you guys know, it's time to tie a ribbon on it for this week's Shoot the Moon podcast. Hopefully you enjoyed the topic and learned a little something along the way. We encourage you to tune in next week. We'll unpack further topics and ideas around growth strategy and M&A for tech-enabled services companies. With that, we'll call it a wrap. Make it a great week.